Information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
We care.
Appear to border
and it
on
shows.
The law.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
When all the documentation suggests that hardworking, honest citizens who believe in God, life, liberty are terrorists, then this country is in danger. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the 133rd episode of MediaMonarchy.com. It's July 24th, 2009. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster for all the news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. We've got Cyber 9/11 and the Corbett Report, National Level Exercise 09, FEMA foreign troops and private military contractors, Catherine Bigelow in Portland for the Hurt Locker, Space War Anniversary, Operation Mockingbird, and the death of Walter Cronkite, plus God and government corruption in New Jersey. All that and so much more in this huge episode 133 of MediaMonarchy.com.
Children, you're acting like children. Every generation thinks it's the end of the world. All you fat followers get fit fast. Every generation thinks it's the last. Thinks it's the end of the world. It's a dream down a well. It's a long, heavy hell. I don't care anymore. I don't care anymore. It's a field we transcend. If we're here at the end, I don't care. Your age, back to back meadows and pearls. While all your sword swallowers pull yourselves together, every generation thinks it's the worst, thinks it's the end of the world. It's a secret I can't tell. As a witch down a well. I don't care anymore. I don't care anymore. It's a long, heavy hell. Synthesize about time.
brand new music from Wilco. From their new album, Wilco, the album. That's a track called You Never Know. Come on, children, you're acting like children. Every generation thinks it's the end of the world. But no, really, this time, well, we'll just see. Ladies and gentlemen, let me once again, and now more formally, welcome you to the 133rd episode of MediaMonarchy.com. It's July 24th, 2009. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show. And this transmission, as always, originates from the home base of the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time. Our wonderful list of affiliates and syndicates like ZeroPointRadio.com, also blasting out in Casper, Wyoming, 92.3 at 11 a.m. Mountain Time. As always, the worldwide home of free speech, RevereRadio.net, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And thanks to Free Radio Olympia, FrOlympia.org, The Fro, 98.5, rebroadcasting Media Monarchy, Saturday mornings, 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Boulder, FreeRadio.com, KBFR, 93.9. And of course, Glenn at CascadiaPublicRadio.org. A nice bit of news, an announcement, and a welcome back to our friends at Ground Zero Radio out of Georgia. They were carrying Media Monarchy last year, but like many LPFM operations, sometimes have to duck and cover and bob and weave. But they are back in Canton, Georgia, 87.9 FM. Also available on stickam.com/groundzeroradio, rebroadcastingmediamonarchy.com, Saturday mornings at 8 a.m. Eastern Time. So again, thanks to the fine folks at Ground Zero Radio. Not to be confused with Clyde Lewis and the Ground Zero Lounge. There's more than one way to interpret Ground Zero. And you know how to get in touch with me. And I thank the slowly but surely increasing numbers of you who are getting in touch with me, leaving comments on the website, on the Facebook page, and all around. And again, I like that mix that folks I've never met who like the show can now rub elbows with my old friends and family that wonder, what the hell? You've really gone down the conspiracy hole, haven't you? I'll admit that if you admit that you've gone down the coincidence theory hole. Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, YouTube, Yahoo, Gmail, Skype, Instant Messenger, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org, all using Media Monarchy as the username or keyword. So there you go. There we go. There's the business, my friends. But there is, of course, more important business to deal with. It makes my head spin. The amount of news, the amount of insanity going on in the world. And there are a lot of important things to go over on this episode. And I just hope that I'm up to a good job. I try and do the best I can to make the information accessible, flesh it out, have it make sense, and also point you in directions where you can go and do further research. But I don't do the best job in the world, but I try my best. I'm a one-man band. So, again, put quite simply, I thank all you guys for all your support. Glancing at Google News, of course, on this July 24th morning. It's the big Henry Louis Gates hullabaloo, of course. Arrested at his home. We'll touch on that just quickly again. on the one hand, things like this are media sideshow circus distractions. But on another level, it does remind us that there are interesting, pressing, controversial issues dealing with race that we haven't really dealt with. And so, ultimately, that's a good thing. Vandals torched 32 golf carts at a West Virginia country club. Not condoning vandalism or violence, but golf courses are, of course, one of the biggest, elitist wastes of resources in the world. So no tears shed for those 32 golf carts at a West Virginia country club. Of course, I'm born and raised West Virginia, 28 years, been in Portland for only 4, so I always pay attention to things going down in my home state, almost heaven. Ron Paul says, make love, not war, to fund healthcare. Gee, imagine that. Imagine ditching the whole erroneous war of terror. And we can have the little arguments about what socialism is or libertarianism is and all those sorts of things. But if you gave the average person the choice, it's like, well, we're going to spend your money one way or the other. Would you like that money to be spent on military robots and drones and wars of aggression and wars for resources? Would you rather put a guy on the moon? Or put a guy in an apartment, as David Cross said? I think the answer is pretty simple, and I know even Jella Biafra talked about this in a bit of his spoken word. Line item taxation, if on your tax forms, and again, sidestepping the issue of the income tax. If you gave people the choice, where do you want the percentages of your money to go? Do you want it to go to food and healthcare and education, or do you want it to go to the war machine? So when we strip away all the left and right phony paradigms and bullshit, and again, we try our best to be nonpartisan here, both sides completely corrupt, but I think we could all agree on that. Do you want food and love and shelter? Or do you want war and death and destruction? It's a pretty simple choice there, actually. So, you know, you want fear or love? We'll, of course, glance back several times at Google News to see what's happening. Sometimes miss those breaking news stories. Of course, things slip out on Friday afternoon after I've done the live show and I'm just doing the post-production. Then something big happens. Somebody dies or somebody resigns. Oh, damn. But I can't do it all. But that apparently doesn't stop me from trying. Finally, thankfully, amazingly, great interview with James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. James Corbett has now been, for a while now, a good friend to MediaMonarchy.com. And I so admire the work that he does. Blows me away. Again, James Corbett, Clyde Lewis. James Corbett and I spoke late Sunday evening on July 19th. He was still in Japan. He's gone on vacation. Much deserved. Corbett Report show is on hiatus, so maybe, in a way, I can help kind of fill that in. So he's out relaxing, but I can still bring you his powerful information and his amazing new article, 9/11 and Cyber Terrorism. What if the cyber 9/11 happened on 9/11? What if the recent cyber attacks were being used to prep us, the U.S., for an I-9-11 event, which would, of course, provide the pretext for a cyber equivalent of the Constitution-destroying Patriot Act, ready to be rubber-stamped into law. All, of course, it requires is a cyber 9-11 to make such legislation politically viable. And what if, speaking to those in the 9-11 research community, what if instead of focusing on the controlled demolition controversies of 9-11, we focused on the documented connections between the intelligence agencies and the terrorists? But more specifically, what if there was a software company that had a backdoor into the computer systems of the FAA, NORAD, and the Pentagon on the morning of 9-11? And furthermore, what if that company was founded and funded and helped along by a specially designated global terrorist? That according to the press release from the State Department. So in this recent special interview episode from Media Monarchy, we talked to James Corbett of CorbettReport.com about his important new article, 9-11 and Cyber Terrorism. What if the real cyber 9-11 happened on 9-11? And again, to put this all quite simply, this is an incredible story of a vulgar betrayal that cuts to the heart of what really happened on 9-11 and what we're facing with the growing hype of a cyber 9-11. For me, we need to go to some of the people and the businesses and the places and the transaction. And what's that famous maxim? Follow the money. So in an effort to not focus all the time on the quote-unquote controlled demolitions, give us just a brief thumbnail and then we'll flesh it out further on your new article, 9-11 and Cyber Terrorism.
Well, first, let me just say that I agree wholeheartedly with you about the demolitions and the way that the 9-11 truth movement has become, at least in the eyes of people outside of that that research community, it's become nothing but the demolitions. And I think it's important to widen the scope of the investigation in the general public's mind, because I fear something like what happens with the JFK assassination, where when you mention it, everyone will think about the magic bullet theory, or did he get shot from the side or the back? And it all becomes about the ballistics of the actual shots themselves, where when you actually start to look into things like, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald's incredible past and the various people he was tied to and all of the things about, you know, E. Howard Hunt's confession. And when you start to look at the other aspects of that, rather than just the physical evidence of what happened that day, the story starts to become that much more important and that much more contextualized. But moving into this article, the 9-11 cyber terrorism, I guess to contextualize this, I think right now, obviously, what you've been covering on MediaMonarchy.com recently is the expanding hysteria, media-fueled hysteria about the cyberspace war. And by the way, cyberspacewar.com, I'm looking forward to that. I hope you get it up soon. Now is the time for a site like that to aggregate this type of news, because there's no doubt they're moving towards that direction as we speak. We've seen so much happening in that general frame of reference over the last few months, from Rockefeller's Senator Jay Rockefeller's new bill that will essentially allow the president the power through his cybersecurity czar to shut down the internet, which is what the Mother Jones article that appeared recently was about. And we've seen the setting up of the new cyber command under U.S. Stratcom to be headed by the chief of the NSA, of course. We see all this preparation getting set up for this gigantic cybersecurity infrastructure, which the New York Times has admitted is now a multi-billion dollar industry, and all of the largest defense contractors are racing to get their piece of that pie. So there's no doubt there's just this huge infrastructure being set up right now. And of course, as with everything else, if they set up this huge infrastructure, there will have to be some type of catalyzing event for the public to recognize and realize the importance of what they're doing, so that they can justify these billions and billions of dollars of expenditures and these broad sweeping new powers. And of course, just as 9-11 served as the catalyzing event for all of the various changes to society that we've seen over the last 8 years, people have started to pump up the idea of a cyber 9/11 as some cyber war type event that's going to come along and change everyone's perception of the internet and how we should relate to it and what types of powers the government needs in order to justify this new cyber command, which, you know, surprise, surprise, it's already been set up. It's already ready to go. Now all we need is the cyber war, the cyber 9/11 event, the catalyzing event. So I think you mentioned on your last episode that you don't think that this new North Korean attack is the cyber 9/11 event, and I don't think so either. I don't think this is going to be the event that justifies all of what's taking place right now. But certainly,
it's going to have to. I would think it's going to have to hit people in their Twitter. It's going to have to hit them in their Facebook, and that's what gives it that massive psychological effect.
Absolutely. I think you're exactly right. It's going to have to be something that does affect people on a more individual basis.
That's just a couple minutes from the hour-long interview that I recently conducted with James Corbett of the Corbett Report about 9/11 and cyber terrorism. In the past several months, as I've been doing more interviews, pre-recorded interviews, I make them self-contained episodes, and I generally haven't been playing clips because there's so much to go over in the flagship episode. But I feel this is so important, I wanted to give you that taster, whet your appetite for the entire hour-long interview. And it's all there. So if you are a subscriber to the podcast feed, you've already gotten it, you've already listened to it, and again, I thank the folks on my Facebook page, folks I don't know who are just fans of the site, who have reached out. They've enjoyed it, they've passed it along, they said they've now subscribed to Corbett Report podcast, and that's what it's all about. There's something that we mentioned in that interview, James called the alternative media working together a virtuous circle. And I like that. That's the opposite of a vicious circle. It's a virtuous circle. And we can all help and grow. And, of course, many hands make light work, as they say. What I want to do now, because, again, this is so important. This is so imperative. We're going to read 9/11 and cyber terrorism. Did the real cyber 9/11 happen on 9/11? This is a great article. You don't have to be a tech expert or a 9/11 truther to wrap your head around this. It's very well written. It's very well sourced. Tons of links within this article. And I think this will show you and help point you in the directions of not just paying attention to the buildings. Perhaps the buildings are the magician's baton twirling around seductively to draw your attention away. Government sources immediately began blaming North Korea for the recent cyber terror attacks on South Korea and the U.S., despite having no evidence to back up those claims. Now, an examination of the evidence by independent computer experts showed that the attack seems to have been coordinated from the U.K., the hysterical media coverage in the attack's wake, however, echoing the government line that it was likely the work of North Korea, served to cement in the minds of many that this was an act of cyber warfare. The idea that this surprisingly unsophisticated attack could have come from a well-organized hostile state or terrorist group comes as a blessing in disguise to those groups, agencies, and advisors who have been calling for greater and greater federal snooping powers in the name of stopping a cyber 9/11 from happening. The cyber 9/11 meme stretches back almost to 9/11 itself. Back in 2003, Mike McConnell, the ex-director of the National Security Agency, the NSA, was fear-mongering over the possibility of a cyber attack, quote, equivalent to the attack on the World Trade Center, end quote, if a new institution were not created to oversee cybersecurity. Since then, report after report has continued to use the horror of 9/11 as a way of raising public hysteria over cyber terrorism, a subject more often associated with juvenile hackers and lone misfits than radical terrorist organizations. The real reason behind the invocation of 9/11 in the context of cyber terror was revealed last year by Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig, L-E-S-S-I-G. He told a technology conference that former counterterrorism czar Richard Clark admits there is a cyber equivalent of the Constitution-destroying Patriot Act ready to be rubber-stamped into law. All it requires is a cyber 9/11 to make such legislation politically viable. In effect, the cybersecurity establishment, the advisors, agents, and experts in the newly minted multi-billion-dollar cybersecurity industry are waiting for a spectacular cyber terror attack to go ahead with the plans for identity management schemes like fingerprinting for internet access, which would put an end to the free internet as we have known it. If you don't believe the fingerprinting for internet access, there's a link to csmonitor.com. What the cybersecurity establishment does not want you to know is the most incredible cyber terrorist story of all time began 15 years ago, and it centers on 9/11. The establishment is interested in suppressing this story because it demonstrates that the very investigative bodies that are clamoring for more power on the pretext of the cyber terror hysteria are the exact same bodies that failed to investigate the documentable links between government-designated terrorists and a software company with direct access to some of the most sensitive computer systems in the United States. FBI agents whose investigation into this story were suppressed, have even said that these investigations could have prevented 9/11. It's a story of international terror and terrorist financiers. It stretches from New England to Saudi Arabia and involves businessmen, politicians, and terror networks. And so it begins in the most unlikely of places, the offices of an enterprise architecture software firm in Quincy, Massachusetts. Enterprise Architecture Software. EAS, Enterprise Architecture Software, refers to a computer program that allows someone to look at all of the data produced throughout an organization structure in real time. This effectively gives the program user a God's eye view of an enterprise, allowing for the mapping, visualization, and analysis of all transactions, interactions, systems, processes, and personnel in the entirety of a business or agency. This type of software could, for example, be used for robust business modeling, allowing for extremely detailed and accurate predictions of how changes in an organization structure or process would affect a business's bottom line. What would happen if two departments were merged, for example, or if a business were to outsource one of its processes? As this software began to mature in the 90s, however, it went from a merely useful tool to something truly incredible. Sophisticated enterprise architecture software could, for example, examine all the transactions taking place across the financial institution in real time and examine that data for possible money laundering operations or rogue traders. Such software could have even potentially detected and identified the insider trading leading up to 9/11. Combined with rudimentary AI capabilities, such a program would not only be able to alert the appropriate personnel about such transactions, but even stop them as they are happening. If the software were sophisticated enough, it may be able to identify the possibility of such transactions before they happen. The utility of such software for organizations of all stripes should be obvious enough. It is surprising, or rather unsurprising, then, that numerous government agencies and powerful corporations were hungry for this software in the 1990s. A surprising number of them, including DARPA, FBI, Secret Service, the White House, the Navy, the Air Force, the FAA, NATO, IBM, Booz Allen Hamilton, and PricewaterhouseCoopers, among many others, turned to a small New England-based software firm called PTECH, P-T-E-C-H. PTECH was founded in Quincy, Massachusetts in 1994, and by 1996 had secured a contract with DARPA to help transfer commercial software methodologies to the defense sector. In 1997, it gained security clearance to bid on sensitive military contracts and bid on work for a range of other government agencies. Within 4 years, PTECH had built up a stable of clients that would make any third-party software vendor green with envy. From the inner sanctum of the White House to the headquarters of the FBI, from the basement of the FAA to the boardroom of IBM, some of the best secured organizations in the world, running on some of the most protected servers, housing the most sensitive data, welcomed PTECH into their midst. PTECH was given the keys to the cyber kingdom to build detailed pictures of these organizations, their weaknesses and vulnerabilities, and to show how these problems could be exploited by those of ill intent. For all of its incredible success, however, many of the firm's top investors and employees were men with backgrounds that should have been raising red flags at all levels of the government. PTECH was founded on $20 million of startup money. $5 million of which was provided by Yassin Al-Qadi. Yassin Al-Qadi, Yassin Al-Qadi, a wealthy and well-connected Saudi businessman who liked to brag about his acquaintance with Dick Cheney. He also had connections to various Muslim charities suspected of funding international terrorism. In the wake of 9/11, he was officially declared a specially designated global terrorist by the U.S. government, and all his assets were frozen. At the time, PTEC's owners and senior management denied that Al-Qadi had any involvement with the company other than his initial investment. But the FBI now maintains they were lying and that, in fact, Al-Qadi continued investing millions of dollars in the company through various fronts and investment vehicles. Company insiders told FBI officials that they were flown to Saudi Arabia to meet PTEC's investors in 1999 and that Al-Qadi was introduced as one of the owners. It's also been reported that Hussein Ibrahim, PTEC's chief scientist, was Al-Qadi's representative at PTEC, and Al-Qadi's lawyers have admitted that Al-Qadi's representative may have continued to sit on PTEC's board even after 9/11. Hussein Ibrahim himself was a former president of BMI, a New Jersey-based real estate investment firm that was also one of the initial investors in PTEC and provided financing for PTEC's founding loan. PTEC leased office space and computer equipment from BMI, and BMI shared office space in New Jersey with Qadi International. That's K-A-D-I. Qadi International, owned and operated by none other than PTEC's sweetheart investor and specially designated global terrorist Yassin Al-Qadi. In 2003, counterterrorism czar Richard Clark said, quote, BMI held itself out publicly as a financial services provider for Muslims in the U.S., its investor list suggests the possibility this facade was just a cover to conceal terrorist support. Suhail Lahair was PTEC's chief architect. When he wasn't writing the software that would provide PTEC with detailed operational blueprints of the most sensitive agencies in the U.S. government, he was writing articles in praise of Islamic holy war. He was also fond of quoting Abdullah Azzam, Osama bin Laden's mentor, and the head of Maktub al-Kidamat, which was the precursor to Al-Qaeda. That such an unlikely cast of characters were given access to some of the most sensitive agencies in the U.S. federal government is startling enough. That they were operating software that allowed them to map, analyze, and access every process and operation within these agencies for the purpose of finding systemic weak points is equally startling. Most disturbing of all, though, is the connection between PTEC and the very agencies that so remarkably failed in their duty to protect the American public on September 11, 2001. For 2 years prior to 9/11, PTEC was working to identify potential problems or weaknesses in the FAA's response plans to events like a terrorist hijacking of a plane over U.S. airspace. According to their own business plan for their contract with the Federal Aviation Administration, PTEC was given access to every process and system in the FAA dealing with their crisis response protocols. This included examining key systems and infrastructure to analyze the FAA's network management, network security, configuration management, fault management, performance management, application administration, network management, and user desk help operations. In short, PTEC had free rein to examine every FAA system and process for dealing with the exact type of event that was to occur on 9/11. Even more incredibly, researcher Indira Singh points out that PTEC was specifically analyzing the potential interoperability problems between the FAA, NORAD, and the Pentagon in the event of an emergency over U.S. airspace. PTEC also presumably had operational information about the systems that the FAA, NORAD, and others employed during crisis response exercises like Vigilant Guardian, the NORAD exercise that was taking place on 9/11 and included simulations of hijacked jets being flown into New York and hijacked jets being flown into government buildings. This is significant, because there's every indication that just such drills were confusing NORAD's response to the real hijackings that were taking place that day. As researcher Michael Rupert points out, a rogue agent with access to a PTEC backdoor into the FAA system could have been deliberately inserting fake blips onto the FAA's radars on 9/11. That scenario would explain the source of the Phantom 11 flight that the FAA reported to NORAD at 9:24 a.m., well after Flight 11 had already hit the World Trade Center. A report whose source the 9/11 Commission claims they were unable to find. In short, PTEC software was running on the critical systems responding to the attacks of 9/11 on 9/11 itself. The software was designed for the express purpose of giving its users a complete overview of all the data flowing through an organization in real time. The father of enterprise architecture himself, John Zachman, Z-A-C-H-M-A-N, explained that with PTEC-type software installed on a sensitive server, quote, you would know where the access points are, you would know how to get in, you would know where the weaknesses are, you'd know how to destroy it. Stifled investigations. In the late 1990s, Robert Wright, an FBI special agent in the Chicago field office, was running an investigation into terrorist financing called Vulgar Betrayal. From the very start, the investigation was hampered by higher-ups. The investigation was not even allocated adequate computers to carry out its work. Through Wright's foresight and perseverance, however, the investigation managed to score some victories, including seizing $1.4 million in U.S. funds that traced back to Yasin al-Qadi. Wright was pleased when a senior agent was assigned to help investigate the founder and the financer of PTEC, but the agent did no work and merely pushed papers during his entire time on the case. Shortly after the 1998 African embassy bombings, Vulgar Betrayal began to uncover a money trail linking al-Qadi to the attacks. According to Robert Wright, when he proposed a criminal investigation into the links, his supervisor flew into a rage saying, quote, you will not open criminal investigations. I forbid any of you. You will not open criminal investigations against any of these intelligence subjects. Wright was taken off the Vulgar Betrayal investigation 1 year later, and the investigation itself was shut down the following year. In the aftermath of 9/11, Indira Singh, S-I-N-G-H, Indira Singh, a risk management consultant for J.P. Morgan. She was looking for enterprise architecture software to implement the next generation of risk management at the financial juggernaut. Impressed by their client list, Indira Singh invited PTEC to demonstrate their software. It wasn't long before she began discovering the connections between PTEC and the international terrorist financing. She worked exhaustively to document and uncover these links in an effort to persuade the FBI in Boston to open up their own investigation into PTEC, but she was told by one agent that she was in a better position to investigate this than someone inside the FBI. Despite the persistent efforts of Singh and the testimony of company insiders, the FBI did not inform any of the agencies contracting with PTEC that there were concerns about the company or its software. In late 2002, Operation Green Quest, a Customs Department-led multi-agency investigation into terrorist financing, raided PTEC's offices due to its ties to al-Qadi and others. The very same day of the raid, White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer declared the company and its software safe. Mainstream news articles defending PTEC after the story broke, however, blithely admit that the company was informed of the raid weeks in advance, hoping perhaps that readers will not notice that this completely defeats the purpose of such a raid or calls into question its results. Eventually, Michael Chertoff led an effort to give the FBI total control over GreenQuest, including leading to customs officials accusing him of sabotaging the investigation. No indictments were laid in the immediate aftermath of the PTEC raid against al-Qadi or anyone else related to the company. Chertoff went on to become the head of Homeland Security. The 9/11 Commission report obviously does not mention PTEC, given the incredible information about this company and its links to specially designated global terrorist Yasin al-Qadi. This is perhaps surprising. This startling omission becomes more ominous, however, when it's understood that the 9/11 Commission co-chair, Thomas Keene, made $24 million off a land deal with al-Qadi-linked organization BMI. For over a decade, investigations into PTEC, its employees, and its investors have been stifled, suppressed, or derailed by people in key positions. But all that finally changed last week. Last Wednesday, the Boston field office of the FBI unsealed a 2007 indictment of Usama Ziad, Z-I-A-D-E, P-TECH's former CEO. They also unsealed an indictment against Buford George Peterson, the former CFO and COO of P-TECH. The indictment charges that the parent knowingly lied to investigators about the extent of Al-Qaeda's investments and ties with P-TECH. Another unsealed indictment, this one from 2005, alleges Ziad attempted to engage in transactions involving Al-Qaeda's property, a federal offense as Al-Qaeda was a specially designated global terrorist at the time. If the pair, that being Ziad and Peterson, are convicted on the charges, they face 30 years in prison and $1 million fine. Whether this represents a significant breakthrough in the case and the beginning of the official unraveling of the P-TECH story will likely depend on whether political pressure is brought to bear by an informed public or concerned with the story. Given that the public has been whipped into cyber hysteria over the North Korea figments of the government's imagination, it will require the media to stop parroting the government's talking points and begin informing the public about the very real, documentable links between terrorist financers and the technology capability to override key emergency response systems on 9/11. Two questions remain to be answered. Did the real cyber 9/11 happen on 9/11? And will the public care enough to demand the answer to that question? If the answer to either question is yes, concerned readers and listeners are advised to check out episode 45 of the Corbett Report podcast, P-TECH and the 9/11 software, and begin distributing it to others to bring awareness to this incredible story. That's James Corbett's article, 9/11 and Cyber Terrorism, in its entirety, read into the record for you. There are dozens of links within that story, State Department, History Commons, Forbes, all around the world. And so, that's the question. Is this story important enough to 9/11 truthers and anyone else interested in what's going on? Are you going to get out the word? So again, I thank James Corbett a lot for taking the time to talk about 9/11 and cyber terrorism. And I think I've exhaustively laid it all out for you there. We're now on to another huge story of the week. And though it seems that every other week, there's another huge terror drill going down in the North American Union. We, of course, last month were watching very closely Ardent Century 09, and of course how it all tied in with the bizarre meme known as Operation Blackjack. But now, what are we looking at? I warned you on Media Monarchy many, many months ago. We mentioned it in April. We mentioned it last November when it was first announced. But it starts Monday, July 27th to the 31st, National Level Exercise 09, NLE 09. FEMA, foreign troops, and private military contractors unite. Massive preparation is well underway for National Level Exercise 09 FEMA Terror Prevention Drills, again from July 27th through the 31st, all next week. These drills, formerly known as Top Off, which for those of us here in Portland, Oregon, we know Top Off very well. Top Off 4, of course, took place in downtown Portland, Oregon. We had Chertoff, the head of Homeland Stupidity, himself running around. And there were strange things indeed. You'll just have to go on Media Monarchy and hit the Top Off link, and you can read about how the bomb-sniffing dogs found bomb residue on some of the vans, and that the drill somehow seemed to go live for a moment. So these drills, National Level Exercise 09, formerly known as Top Off, are being brought to you in part by Northrop Grumman and its teammates, which include ICF International out of Fairfax, Virginia, Battelle, and the Battelle Memorial Institute, that's B-A-T-T-E-L-L-E, Battelle, out of Columbus, Ohio. They, of course, have the anthrax connections. Alutiiq, out of Anchorage, Alaska, A-L-U-T-I-I-Q, Alutiiq out of Anchorage, L3 Communications and MPRI out of Alexandria, Virginia, Unitech out of Centerville, Virginia, and Interface Media Group out of Washington, D.C. They're all performing this drill in support of FEMA in D.C. and the South Central states within FEMA's Region 6, which include Arkansas, Louisiana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas. This posting, NLE09, FEMA Foreign Troops and Private Military Contractors Unite, is replete with all the links and documentation I can find relating to the exercise, all linked up, things from around the world, things I had to translate through Google. But perhaps the most succinct breakdown comes in the form of a letter to the editor on the Augusta Chronicle. This is out of, I believe, Louisiana, and I may be wrong. We'll have to check that. Chronicle.augusta.com. Upcoming police exercise is unsettling. There will be a government exercise conducted July 27th through the 31st. It's called National Level Exercise 09 or NLE 09. Although the focus of this exercise is on terrorism, it will not be focused on bearded men from the Middle East. The focus will be on internal threats, Americans. If this seems a bit absurd to the reader, let me expound on it. The Pentagon, in their own documents, and the Missouri State Highway Patrol, and the Virginia State Police, in their own documents, have labeled Americans as possible terrorist threats. These people are known as Christians, pro-life activists, gun rights advocates, homeschoolers, Ron Paul supporters, 9/11 truth activists, Tea Party demonstrators, etc. If this is hard to believe, one only need to type Missouri Information Analysis Center into a search engine to learn more. You may remember it as being the MIAC report, M-I-A-C. Also, Shreveport, Louisiana Mayor Cedric Glover apparently has suspended the Second Amendment in his city. The writer of this letter spoke to an aide in his office who confirmed that. That only came to light when citizen Robert Baillio, B-A-I-L-L-I-O, was stopped and his gun, which he had a permit for, was taken. He also had pro-gun stickers on his vehicle. There are links in there to conservativedrink.com and also to ksla.com for more on that story. The aforementioned exercise will focus on terrorism prevention, and that sidebar is the difference between this and many of the other drills. All the other drills center around something happening, some fake explosion or whatever, and they spring into action. This is a prevention. So what do you do to prevent things? What's Crime Stop? Precog. This exercise will be a multinational, multi-agency effort. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, the Department of Homeland Security, state, county, local, and tribal agencies will focus on intelligence and information gathering. Military troops from Britain, Australia, Canada, and Mexico will be participants in this drill this year. Rumors have been circulating for quite a while of foreign troops on U.S. soil, and now it's happening. All this info can be found in the NLE09 press release on FEMA.gov. When all the documentation suggests that hardworking, honest citizens who believe in God, life, and liberty are terrorists, then this country's in danger. The focus of the exercise is unsettling. If the mayor of one city can suspend our rights, what is the full might and muscle of our federal government capable of? And that's a letter written in to the Augusta Chronicle by Rick James. And it says he's from Wagoner, South Carolina. So there we go. As I mentioned, tons of links, tons of info in here that you can follow. RightsideNews.com, WorldNet Daily, ISRIA.com. But we also have a few little supplemental pieces like this out of Vancouver. Canada's Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the RCMP's Integrated Security Unit, ISU, they say they're not involved in the drill. I believe I posted this up before, but it's worth posting up again, at least a link in the headline. FEMA and Israeli Defense Forces heads met together, presumably so they can teach each other how to take over cities that don't belong to them. FEMA takes martial law prep to the next level. That's from Kurt Nemo. And what prefaces a bit of this, and again, a press release from FEMA.gov, FEMA administration meets with governors to discuss emergency preparedness. So they've met with the Israeli military, and I'm not trying to invoke some crazy Jewish conspiracy. That's bullshit. But then FEMA met with the governors of states. It was a handful of states, and again, you can find out by just checking out that press release. They've met with the governors to perhaps prep them for what may be coming down the pipe. NLE 09, FEMA, foreign troops, and private military contractors unite. Again, I implore you to check out the links, check out the information, and just be vigilant and pay attention to what's going on. If you just type NLE 09 or FEMA or exercises and look at the most recent videos and things posted up, either to Google or YouTube or what have you, there are a lot of people paying attention to this. And that's a good thing. Why do we pay attention to the drills? I've said this many, many times, but perhaps you're a new listener. Drills can sometimes be used as a cover to turn it into the real thing. And we try not to make the mistake of saying the government or the CIA or the FBI. All these agencies are made up of people. And a lot of these people are compartmentalized. And so, say you're working in a factory, you just put some widget in a box, but you don't know what happens when you send it on down the conveyor belt. That's how these drills can work, and that's how the compartmentalization can work in some of these agencies. So we had multiple drills going on in the morning of 9/11, many of which dealing with hijacked jets crashing into government buildings. And what do you know? It just happens. And as we, of course, just covered, perhaps we know more about how that happened, thanks to the P-TECH story. July 7th, 2005, 7/7 in London. Bombings, same buses, same trains, same times as the drill. Drills involving Peter Power and Visor Consultants. It just happened to go live and the exact buses and trains were hit. That's why we pay attention to the drills. And again, I've said many, many times, perhaps we become a victim of the success because we bring a lot of attention to these drills. Unfortunately, many people say, oh shit, this is it, watch out, it's going down, this is it, it's martial law, here it is, here it comes, lock and load. And you keep crying wolf. And maybe that's another element of what these drills are designed to do. They're designed to draw people like us out. And of course, they track me tracking these stories. We have to be very careful. But again, shedding light on the information, sunshine. What I want to try and do real quick, and this may not work, but we're going to give it a shot. There's a number at the bottom of the press release on the FEMA website. dealing with national level exercise 09. Let's try and Skype this number and see what happens when we dial it up. It might be a recording, it might be a human, this might totally not work, and I'll apologize in advance if this fails.
Thank you for calling FEMA's Office of External Affairs. Please listen carefully to the following options. If you're a member of the media and have an inquiry, press 1. For general public affairs questions, please press 2. If you're with a state, local, or tribal government and would like to speak with someone in intergovernmental affairs, press 3. To speak with someone in community relations, press 4. For our Office of International Affairs, press 5. If you'd like to speak with someone in our Office of Legislative Affairs, press 6. If you've been affected by a disaster and would like to register for assistance, or if you've already registered and have questions or would like to check on the status of your application, please hang up now and call 1-800-621-FEMA. That's 1-800-621-3362.
Well, was it media for
operator,
one?
Zero, or simply stay on the line. Once again, thank you for calling FEMA's Office of External Affairs.
Let's hit one and see what happens. Hello?
Yeah.
Hi, my name's James, and I run a news website called Media Monarchy, and I was just kind of wondering about the national-level exercise that's going on next week.
Mm-hmm.
I know friends and have people who are always talking about FEMA and all these bad things and foreign troops and stuff, and what's kind of the breakdown on it?
I can send you an email giving you the information that's on it, posted on our website that tells you about the national exercise. What's your name again, James?
My name's James Pilato. P-I-L-A-T-O.
P-I-L-A-T-O?
Yes.
Okay, and a phone number for you, James?
Actually, can I just give you an email address?
Okay, are you with the media?
I am. I do a radio show and a website. It's small, but...
Okay, but this is our process because we input this into our database. So if you can provide it for me, that would be helpful. Otherwise, I can just give you our email address, website information, and you can go and look for it yourself.
Okay, I guess I just wondered if just some of the sort
of... there is information on our website that you can actually access. There's a press release and a fact sheet.
Okay.
That give you what the whole exercise is about. And that's at www.fema.gov.
Okay. Well,
in the search engine, type in NLE09.
Okay.
And click on National Level Exercise, and it'll take you to the press release.
Okay, and actually, and I did just look at that. I don't know. I guess I'm just asking if there's any kind of more information you can give me on, like, because I know that, like, Northrop Grumman is involved.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way to find out, I guess, who all's involved in running the drill? Because I don't really see that on the press release, though.
No, that information will be updated. Daily next week,
as the exercises start,
it's taking place. So if you would like to be included in that information, we send it out to our media distribution list.
Okay, and that would be the phone number and stuff, and you would add me to the list.
Yes, if you provide me your media information.
Okay, well let's go ahead and do that then.
Okay, what's your phone number?
It's 503.
Okay, and what's the media outlet again?
It's a news website called MediaMonarchy.com.
It's a news website?
It's a website and also a radio show.
And what's the name of it again?
Media. MediaMonarchy.com.
Uh-huh. And an email address for you, James?
It would be mediamonarchy@gmail.com.
Okay. And like I said, right now the information is posted on our website. So
Okay, and so maybe once the exercises are going, you said there'll be updates, and maybe there'd be a way that I could actually get in touch with someone and kind of talk to them, or, you know, sort of a quick interview blurb or something?
Actually, I could have someone give you a call back today that you can speak to if you'd like to do that. In addition to any additional questions, you can just tell me what your questions are, and I'll have a liaison get back with you.
Okay. Well, let me just get the email from you, and then I'll kind of proceed from there.
Okay. Which email? Because you said you were going to go online. So you want me to send you the information?
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead and send me the information online. I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. I'll do that.
All right.
Okay. MediaMonarchy@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gotcha. Monarchy, like a, you know, like royalty.
Gotcha. Okay.
All right. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, there you go. Perhaps it wasn't the greatest thing in the world, but also wasn't going to start jumping down her throat about foreign troops and martial law exercises. She probably wouldn't take into that very well. And there you go, busting out phone numbers and such. But that's how you do it. And I'm glad I did that, and that was a good exercise even for me doing that here live on the air. That kind of shows me that I'm able to do it. All I did was hook up the laptop into the board, spoke into the mic on the laptop as well as my studio mic. I wasn't sure if there was going to be a delay or a feedback or what have you, but hell, there you go. So there's a live phone call to FEMA about national level exercise, and I gave them lots of information, so let's see what this turns into, and or perhaps what I've gotten myself into. And my friends, now is the perfect time for me to tell you that we're into hour number 2 of episode 133 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's July 24th, 2009. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com. Blasting out on all our wonderful affiliates, of course, originating from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, zeropointradio.com, revereradio.net, frolympia.org, boulderfreeradio.com, cascadiapublicradio.org, and stickam.com/groundzeroradio. Again, welcoming back our friends in Georgia, Ground Zero Radio, 87.9 FM in Canton, Georgia. We can ease back a little bit, and we'll dip into the media memes in the world of film and war. Director Catherine Bigelow was in Portland this last Monday to discuss her new film, The Hurt Locker. Catherine Bigelow, director of films such as Point Break, Strange Days, and Near Dark, was in Portland at the Hollywood Theater this last Monday night to discuss her powerful and sometimes disturbing new movie, The Hurt Locker. This was a benefit for POW Fest, the Portland, Oregon Women's Film Festival. Ms. Bigelow introed her film to an enthusiastic crowd, and after the movie, the Oregonian's Christy Turnquist served as interview and moderator for questions from the audience, which covered everything from the technical aspects of the film, like what they shot on and how they edited it and the sound and DPs and all that stuff, and even closed out with a personal account from a woman in the audience whose husband is a Gulf War veteran, and I believe she said even worked in sort of bomb squad situations, who couldn't even bring himself to come see this movie. It's Catherine Bigelow's The Hurt Locker.
Can it be an Iraq war drama worth talking about? The buzz is building up around The Hurt Locker when members of a bomb disposal team in the midst of the Iraq war find themselves drawn into the midst of urban warfare by their new sergeant when they're supposed to be going home soon. What will happen to their unit? Check out the explosive trailer.
Welcome to Camp Victory.
Oh, Camp Victory? This was Camp Liberty.
Oh, no, they changed that about a week ago. Victory sound better.
All right.
So what do you got?
The car has been parked illegally.
Suspension is sagging. There's definitely something heavy in the trunk.
Interesting.
What's he doing?
I'm gonna die. I wanna die comfortable.
How many bombs have you disarmed?
873.
873?
You're a wild man, you know that?
Oh, that's so bad. Our first time working together? What do you think?
I think us working together means I talk to you and you talk to me.
You going on a date, Sanborn?
My team leader is expiring. He's gonna get me killed.
What's the best way to go about disarming one of these things?
The way you don't die, sir. That was good.
What do we have here?
This box is full of stuff. It almost killed me.
And what about this one? Where's this one from, Will?
It's my wedding ring. Like I said, stuff that almost killed me.
Put down the phone!
Round him, Aldrin!
I can't get a shot!
I was scared.
Yeah?
Well, everyone's a coward about something.
We're going on a mission. And my job is to keep you safe so we can keep going on missions.
It's combat, buddy.
Go!
Everybody get back!
Go, go!
You realize every time you suit up, it's life or death.
Found something.
You roll the dice. And you deal with it.
That's the trailer from Kathryn Bigelow's new film, The Hurt Locker. Some critics are calling it a near-perfect movie, a full-tilt action picture, ferociously suspenseful. I will say it's really well done. It's very tense. It's even funny at parts. You get to see a little bit of Ralph Fiennes and Guy Pearce, but they don't last very long. Wasn't quite the full-on knockout punch I'd perhaps been hyped up to hope that it would be. But a quick clip from Anne Hornaday's review from the Washington Post. War is a drug, writes Chris Hedges in the epigraph that precedes The Hurt Locker. Someone else described war as interminable boredom punctuated by moments of stark terror. Director Kathryn Bigelow comprehends both those observations and conveys them in this captivating, completely immersive action thriller. The Hurt Locker just happens to be set in Iraq in 2004, but, like the best films, transcends time and place, and in the process attains something universal and enduring. The Hurt Locker is about Iraq in the same way that Paths of Glory was about World War I, or Full Metal Jacket was about Vietnam, which is to say, utterly and not at all. It's interesting that she mentions two other great films, great war films, Paths of Glory and Full Metal Jacket, both, of course, being Stanley Kubrick films. So it was awesome to go to the Hollywood Theater. It's nice to be able to try and support your independent, local film outlets. I mean, here it is. I spent basically $12, which was an inflated price on their regular, cheapy, I think, $6 ticket price. $12 got me the movie and Kathryn Bigelow and Gus Van Sant hanging out in the audience, sipping wine out of a plastic cup. So for $12, I could go see a great new movie, see and hear the director talk about the film, and support the local independent outlets. Go to Regal Theater and you spend $12 on one ticket, and that's all you got. And you got bullshit trailers and the 20 and a bunch of garbage. I guess what I'm trying to say is support your local media outlet. Now, my friends, a couple of stories that we've prefaced and built up and mentioned on some of the previous episodes. Of course, the cyberspace war meme is fully out there. And again, not that it's exactly new, but a lot of it has really been pushed into the public consciousness through the Obama era. So with our new savior, all these new things are coming into play. All the tech aspects. So you can again see the way that it would tie in with, you know, the most internet-connected presidency ever, with YouTube videos and all that kind of stuff, and Twitter feeds and yada yada. So it makes perfect sense that we're going to build up and see more hype about a so-called cyber 9/11 as we all get wrapped up in the online world. Myself guiltily included. I need to just cut and run sometimes and go sit by a lake. Spacewalk number 2 unfolded on the 40th moon anniversary. This report from the Associated Press: the astronauts aboard the shuttle station complex were celebrating the 40th anniversary of man's first moon landing with their own spacewalk. Of course, Tuesday, July 20th, was the 40th anniversary. Late Monday morning, the day before, David Wolf and Thomas Mashburn ventured out to hook spare parts to the International Space Station, the ISS. It's the second spacewalk in 3 days, and it was taking place 40 years to the day that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. How cool, is how one shuttle astronaut described it. The space station crew, meanwhile, was working on a broken toilet that malfunctioned last Sunday. For the time being, the 13 astronauts are lining up at the two good toilets, one on the station and one on Endeavour. NASA says it's not yet a serious problem. So there we mention astronauts and toilets, but let's get the word from our astro men themselves.
I think for the first time, maybe, in human history, we had a people of the whole world with a sense of it was a major time for all mankind, that this was a step that nobody had ever done before, and it was something that meant a lot to people all over the world. Now, it's too bad, of course, we can't keep that same kind of dedication, because everyone shared in the success of this historic mission. It's too bad we just can't continue that attitude day in and day out.
Apollo 11 is a symbol of what a great nation and a great people can do if we work hard, work together, and have strong leaders with vision and determination. That is what Apollo 11 means to us today, to me today. Realizing the dream of exploration by way of determination. What we did 40 years ago was a great mission of exploration. Tonight, I'd like to share with you a glimpse of where we can go in the next 40 years if only we are willing to be truly bold. The best way to honor and remember all those who were part of the Apollo program is to follow in our footsteps, to boldly go again on a great new mission of exploration. We can help make the moon a true stepping stone to more exciting and habitable destinations, with the moon acting as a new global commons for all nations. We can venture outward to Mars for America's future. It may sound like a distant destination beyond our reach, but that's what some call Apollo, goal to reach the moon. And they were wrong.
It was the ultimate peaceful competition, USA versus USSR. I'll not assert that it was a diversion which prevented a war. Nonetheless, it was a diversion. It was intense, and it did allow to both sides to take the high road with the objectives of science and learning and exploration. Eventually, it provided a mechanism for engendering cooperation between former adversaries. In that sense, among others, it was an exceptional national investment for both sides.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. So Tuesday, the 20th, was the anniversary. I was at work. I had fun mentioning to a couple people, hey, today's the big 40th anniversary of the Freemasons and Nazis landing on the moon. And again, that's the way you sometimes plant seeds with people. Just throw out little truth nuggets, and they'll go, what? The Nazis? And you'll go, oh, that's right. Operation Paperclip brought Wernher von Braun, as well as others, to the NASA project, and we learned all their space know-how. Not to mention all the other bits of know-how we picked up from the Nazis. And, of course, the Freemasons and Buzz Aldrin taking his apron and the flag up there. We plant these flags. So if we hop to an article from the Inquisitor, Inquisitor.com, 40 years ago on July 20th, mankind first stepped on a world other than our own, a monumental step forward in American scientists and science, and one giant leap for mankind. Many alive today won't remember a time where a man walked on the moon because no one has been back since 1972. But that hasn't stopped interest in the alleged Apollo 11 hoax. As of 6 p.m. Pacific time on July 20th of this year, Apollo 11 hoax was the most searched term on Google. This so-called Apollo 11 hoax theory is part of a broader set of Apollo moon landing hoax conspiracy theories, according to Wikipedia. Apollo moon landing hoax conspiracy theories are claims that some or all elements of the Apollo moon landings were faked by NASA and possibly members of other involved organizations. Since the conclusion of the Apollo program, a number of related moon hoax accounts have been advanced by various groups and individuals, including claims that the Apollo astronauts did not land on the moon, that NASA and possibly others intentionally deceived the public into believing the landings did occur by manufacturing, destroying, or tampering with evidence, including photos, telemetry tapes, transmissions, and rock samples, and that the deception continues to this day. The Inquisitor closes by saying it's kooky stuff, but if you want to read more on it, Inquisitor.com/JLZ has more video and more images apparently proving the Apollo 11 hoax. Listeners of the show know that I don't generally deal too much with the very esoteric, strange, occult inner workings of the world. However, I won't say for a second that it's stupid or unimportant. It's just something that, through MediaMonarchy.com, trying to get the word out about a lot of the strange things going down in the world, if I'm just trying to get you to hopefully look into and investigate how international banksters and elites generally have funded and controlled all the supposed oppositions throughout the last several hundred years, and they need to create things and fake things to get you to come along with their plans, I suppose what I'm trying to say is investigating the occult and the sinister forces and the symbology and the sacred numerology and all of those things are important. And I implore you to do that work on your own, just as I actually do that work on my own. But again, it's not something I necessarily blast out on MediaMonarchy.com that the moon is fake, it's a hoax. We try and stick with what we can prove. The other story, in addition to the cyberspace war, moon landing attacks and anniversaries that we've been discussing now for several weeks, a couple of weeks ago on the site, we mentioned Walter Cronkite was deathly ill. And the article we mentioned is that he, paraphrasing Mark Twain, I believe, said that the rumors of his demise were greatly exaggerated. So we basically, a couple of weeks ago, prefaced what we knew was coming, and it's come, and that's that legendary, quote-unquote, newsman, Walter Cronkite, died at the age of 92 at his home. And now, Walter Cronkite can truly be glad to sit on the right hand of Satan. What are you talking about, James? What am I talking about? Well, we played this clip, I believe, many months ago when it first was uncovered, or at least was discovered. And that's Walter Cronkite receiving an award from the World Federalist Association or Society. And I think that's a good way to intro this obituary for Uncle Walter. Is that, you know, I guess now he knows whether or not he's glad to sit on the right hand of Satan.
The World Federalist Association, or WFA, is one of the largest organizations that openly promote world government. Periodically, the WFA extends a global governance award to a prominent individual pushing for the same goal. Former CBS anchorman Walter Cronkite was among the recipients of the WFA award.
Thank you very much. Today we must develop federal structures on a global level to deal with world problems. We need a system of enforceable world law, democratic federal world government.
In a closed-circuit hookup, Hillary Clinton congratulated Cronkite.
For decades, told us the way it is. But tonight, we honor you for fighting for the way it could be.
In 1993, the WFA honored an editor for Time magazine for an essay he had written entitled, The Birth of the Global Nation.
Nationhood as we know it will be obsolete. All states will recognize a single global authority.
After receiving the award, the editor, Strobe Talbott, was appointed Deputy Secretary of State in the Clinton administration. In February 2000, the New York Times allowed the WFA a full-page ad to spread its globalist propaganda.
Pat Robertson had written in a book a few years ago that we should have a world government, but only when the Messiah arrives. He wrote, and literally, any attempt to achieve world order before that time must be the work of the devil. Well, join me. I'm glad to sit here at the right hand of Satan.
There it is from Uncle Walter's mouth. And this is the interesting thing. And this is why I don't necessarily believe that there is the one unified, all-powerful system at the top of the pyramid. I think it's perhaps more likely that there are a few groups and motives that are squeezing atop the pyramid. How many angels can dance on the head of a pyramid? And so you have people like Pat Robertson, fake Christian, designed to get God-fearing people to lie down and accept the New World Order. He's talking about world government, but then you have Walter Cronkite making fun of, you know, people who believe in Jesus, and that working on world government before the Messiah returns would be the work of the devil, so of course Walter Cronkite's glad to work for the devil. You gotta wonder why someone would say something like that, though. Being a newsman? He's perhaps more well-versed than most people in the world about what to say and how you say it, or what not to say. Very interesting, to say the least. So let's get the mainline obit from the Deutsche Press Agency, and then we'll break it down a little more, thanks to Kurt Nemo and Alex Constantine. Iconic news anchor Walter Cronkite, whose journalism shaped U.S. views and policies from World War II to the Vietnam War, died last Friday at the age of 92. Cronkite, who was born in St. Joseph, Missouri in 1916, had been ill for several months with cerebrovascular disease. Among the many paying tribute to him were President Barack Obama and his predecessor George W. Bush. Often called the most trusted man in America, Cronkite's deliberate reporting and analysis, together with his rare displays of emotion, made him a key observer and interpreter of seminal moments in U.S. history, including the Kennedy assassination, the civil rights struggle, and, of course, the moon landing. Regarded as one of the all-time greats of U.S. journalism, Cronkite also played a decisive role in establishing television as a leading news medium and in defining the standards for news anchors during his stint as anchor at CBS News from 1962 to 1981. Obama called him, quote, a voice of certainty in an uncertain world. For decades, Walter Cronkite was the most trusted voice in America. His rich baritone reached millions of living rooms every night. He invited us to believe in him, and he never let us down. Walter Cronkite was an icon of American journalism who shaped his profession in countless ways during his decades on the air. Tonight, his family is in our thoughts and prayers, W said. It's impossible to imagine CBS News, journalism, or indeed America without Walter Cronkite, said Sean McManus, president of CBS News. More than just the best and most trusted anchor in history, he guided America through our crises, tragedies, and also our victories and greatest moments. Cronkite established his legendary reputation with his marathon coverage of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in 1963. His sympathetic reporting of the civil rights struggle was key in winning over American public opinion, while his conclusion that the Vietnam War was unwinnable in 1968 eroded the support of middle America for the controversial conflict. If I've lost Cronkite, I've lost middle America, said President Lyndon Baines Johnson after Cronkite concluded that the war could not be won. Katie Couric, the current anchor of the CBS Evening News, said Cronkite was so trusted, quote, because he exhibited a sense of purpose and compassion night after night. He was the personification of excellence.
Hello, I'm Walter Cronkite.
He was the most trusted man in America.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
Walter Cronkite, for many, the quintessential TV journalist, has died. For most Americans, he was the man to turn to on everything from the assassination of President Kennedy to what to think about the war in Vietnam.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
He covered battlefields, the coronation of Queen Elizabeth, and was a familiar presence to all of the presidents he covered. But it was his presence and his ability to tell a story with his Midwestern intonations that endeared him to Americans from coast to coast, always promising, always to report an event the way it is.
Our interview with the senator will be entirely unrehearsed. It will be spontaneous. It will not be edited. Questions have not been submitted to Mr. Kennedy in advance, and I will be asking them of him for the first time.
His familiarity led many to call him Uncle Walter. And although he didn't know them personally, he sometimes shared America's enthusiasm on the air, like when man first walked on the moon.
Man on the moon.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
What?
Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute.
Cronkite left the anchor desk in 1981, handing the reins over to Dan Rather. However, Cronkite wouldn't soon disappear from the American landscape. He backed then-President Clinton when he was suffering through the Monica Lewinsky scandal. He also condemned former President George W. Bush's decision to go to war in Iraq.
If the war we are fighting cannot be sustained with the people knowing what it takes to win that war, then we shouldn't be there in the first place.
Walter Cronkite, dead at the age of 92. Diane Kepley, The Associated Press.
So that's the Associated Press and the Deutsche Press Agency giving the main line, just the facts rundown. However, let's get a little deeper into this. And this reminds me, if you recall, several months ago with the death of Tom Braden, B-R-A-D-E-N. Of course, he, the creator of Crossfire, the show that popularized the left versus the right setup that we're still stuck with to this day. He was, of course, an ex-CIA guy and involved in what was called Operation Mockingbird. That is the somewhat known, somewhat declassified Central Intelligence Agency program of placing people purposefully in positions of power, generally within the media, print, radio, television, who would put out the party line, whatever the party line may be at that moment, whether it's yay something or nay something else. Yay, Richard Nixon. Oh, wait, Richard Nixon's bad. Boo. They put out the official word, And then all the rest of the people on down the pyramid, they aren't in on the scheme. They just repeat it like a mockingbird. Walter Cronkite, most trusted asset of Operation Mockingbird. This from Kurt Nemo. And again, we hear the quote, "It's impossible to imagine CBS News, journalism, or indeed America without Walter Cronkite," said Sean McManus, president of CBS News, on the passing of Walter Cronkite. "More than any, or rather more than just the best and most trusted anchor in history, he guided America through our crises, tragedies, and also our victories and greatest moments." I wonder if Mr. McManus knew the real Cronkite. Cronkite, a former intelligence officer who was lured away from his UPI, United Press International, Moscow desk, by Operation Mockingbird's Phil Graham. That's G-R-A-H-A-M, Phil Graham, the late head of the Washington Post. He published it from 1946 until his death in 1963. He was also co-owner of the Washington Post. He was married to Katherine Graham, who, of course, took over after Phil Graham's death. I wonder if Mr. McManus knew the real Cronkite. Cronkite, the former intelligence officer who was lured away from his UPI Moscow desk by Operation Mockingbird's Phil Graham. Of course he did. Because the corporate media, at least at the level Walter Cronkite occupied, is rife with spooks, government agents, and disinfo operatives. The CIA has quote-unquote important assets inside every major news publication in the country, a fact established by numerous Freedom of Information documents. A rare glimpse into this was also provided by Frank Church's committee in the mid-70s, the Church Committee. Some of the journalists working the CIA's side of the street, quote, were Pulitzer Prize winners, distinguished reporters who considered themselves ambassadors without portfolio for their country, end quote. Carl Bernstein wrote in an article published in Rolling Stone in October 1977. Quote, most were less exalted. Foreign correspondents who found that their association with the agency helped their work. Stringers and freelancers who were as interested in the derring do of the spy business as in filing archives. And the smallest category, full-time CIA employees masquerading as journalists abroad. That's from Carl Bernstein, Rolling Stone article, October 1977, and it is, of course, interesting to note, you know Bernstein from his association with Woodward and Bernstein. Who have you heard more from post-Watergate? There may be more aspects to it than I'm aware, but we see Bob Woodward is quite the trusted investigative journalist. And again, we try and point out and look at the work that people do. Perhaps they're put in as damage control. They know that the toothpaste is coming out of the tube, but they need some of their assets in place to control that damage and create limited hangout and plausible denial. We've posited on this show many times that folks like Bob Woodward and even Seymour Hersh and all your other favorites. Again, I'm not saying they're in on it. They're CIA. They may not know what they're reporting. They could be what are referred to as cutouts. They're given information for a reason. They will put that information out, and because they're a most trusted news source, it will be believed, and more importantly, it will be repeated. We'll now jump to a quote from Alex Constantine's article, "The Depraved Spies and Moguls of the CIA's Operation Mockingbird." Quote, "It was not until 1982 that the agency openly admitted that reporters on the CIA payroll have acted as case officers to agents in the field. Most consumers of the corporate media were, and are, unaware of the effect that the salting of public opinion has on their own beliefs. In the 1950s, outlays for global propaganda climbed to a full third of the CIA's covert operations budget. Some 3,000 salaried and contract CIA employees were eventually engaged in propaganda efforts. The cost of disinforming the world cost American taxpayers an estimated $265 million a year by 1978, a budget larger than the combined expenditures of Reuters, UPI, and the Associated Press news syndicates. End quote. Kurt Nemo wraps up his article about Walter Cronkite, most trusted asset of Operation Mockingbird, by saying, Cronkite was a trusted and valued part of that huge mass propaganda effort. We'll wrap this up in a comical way, but again, as we have many times listened to The Onion or Bill Hicks, you sometimes got to go to comedy and satire for a real way to break down the bullshit. And no one arguably was better at that than the late, great George Carlin, because he didn't believe that shit either.
That fucking Walter Cronkite, I'm glad he's leaving, because I don't believe that shit he does, man. Walter Cronkite, this is Walter Cronkite, what's oil? You ever hear the way he says the word oil? Oil, I think, has one syllable. It's sort of, but it's oil. He says oil. Listen to that, not making fun of Walter. Yes, I am. Oil. Well, the oil field today and the oil companies and the oil industry and the oil prices. That's the way it is. Walter Cronkite.
Bullshit, Walter. That's not the way it is.
So there you go. Even from George Carlin, from beyond the grave, telling you, don't believe that shit. And again, he's doing it humorously, and perhaps even Carlin isn't saying he's a CIA asset disinfo spook. He is at least saying, watch what you watch. The last update on my posting of quote-unquote legendary newsman Walter Cronkite dead at the age of 92. Uncle Walter and the CIA. A quick posting from Alex Constantine's Blacklist. He has three links up. One, the first. Two, the Kurt Nemo article we just read, most trusted asset of Mockingbird. And there's more on Cronkite, belatedly called the war in Vietnam unwinnable, not an atrocity, as it's sometimes been attributed to him. And the last article, Beyond the Hype, Cronkite and the Vietnam War. There's a lot for you to think about there. And I'll even say, as if I have to say this to you guys, don't even trust everything I say. I'm not perfect. I'm trying to do my best. I ain't on the payroll of anybody. I don't take news that's shoved down my throat. I try and look all around the world wide wiretapped web and break through the lies and the disinfo and the scams and the psyops. And try and hopefully shake it all out and make it make sense. I suppose in closing on Walter Cronkite, you got to just think about, even again, the mainline reporting from the DPA and the AP. Walter Cronkite shaped our opinions and emotions on every huge event in American history for a long period of time. JFK assassination, the moon landing, the Vietnam War, all of it. If someone is forming your opinions and emotions for you, shouldn't you perhaps be interested in where they're getting their information, or perhaps what their associations are? Who informed their opinions? And we don't even have time to go into all the connections between CBS and the CIA, and Operation Mockingbird, and on and on and on. But it's there, and it's documented. And we'll, again, quote Jella Biafra by saying, don't hate the media, become the media. Our last huge story is a bizarre one, but it, of course, is no real major surprise. Our misleaders are everywhere. Some have D's after their name. Some have R's after their name. And it doesn't make a goddamn bit of difference. Some worship a cross. Some of them are rabbis. What weaves through all these stories again and again and again is watch for the fake dichotomies. Democrats versus Republicans. Oh, it's the Catholic conspiracy. Oh, it's the Jewish conspiracy. Oh, it's the... No one phony side has the monopoly on corruption. And we can see that fully with this amazing story. Top New Jersey God and government leaders arrested in black market money scandal that even perhaps included, you know, a little organ scandal. The original report I have posted up is from examiner.com. And again, this was the initial report. We'll flesh it out with a more current one in just a moment. But the breakdown. New Jersey top government officials and religious leaders, according to MSNBC, have been arrested in connection with a supposed major corruption and international money laundering conspiracy. And again, they tell us not to think about conspiracies, but if you look at the number one charge leveled against people in federal crimes, it is conspiracy. Reportedly, it was also discovered that many were involved in a black market organ ring. Among those arrested are two New Jersey mayors, an assemblyman, and a city deputy mayor. Several law enforcement agencies, including the FBI and the IRS, are said to be involved in this sting operation that, at the time of this posting, had resulted in approximately 30 arrests. And they say, again, on examiner.com, that this posting is a breaking story, so details are still minimal, but what has been said so far is that the mayors of Hoboken, Peter Camerano, and the mayor of Secaucus, Dennis Elwell, have been arrested. Also included in the arrest were Jersey City Deputy Mayor Leona Baldini, State Assemblyman Daniel Van Pelt, and some rabbis from New York and New Jersey.
Hello, everyone. I'm Contessa Brewer. We are following breaking news right now out of New Jersey. Dozens of public officials, mayors, deputy mayors, rabbis under arrest in what's being called one of the biggest investigations in state history. WNBC's investigative reporter Jonathan Deans joins us. It looks like an international money laundering conspiracy, public corruption. What are you looking at, Jonathan?
We're looking at all of it. They literally are carting the suspects away by the busload here. 30 arrests so far. We're told that number could grow into the 40s when this operation is all said and done. As you said, public officials all across the state. We've got the mayor of Secaucus, the mayor of Hoboken, other public officials from the city of Jersey City. These are all large communities here in New Jersey and all across the state. The FBI and IRS agents have been out making these arrests. Also, as you said, community leaders and several rabbis are arrested in a money laundering scheme that totaled in the tens of millions. We're expecting a news conference later today from the U.S. attorney and FBI officials here in Newark to explain the exact nature of these charges. But clearly, this is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, public corruption roundup in state history. And that's saying a lot, because in just the last few years, this state has seen more than 130 public officials convicted for various public or corruption crimes. And now you've got 20 plus more being rounded up, and that number expected to grow as the hours continue here.
All right.
Back to you.
We'll stay on top of it here at MSNBC throughout the day. Jonathan, thank you.
Now, within this original posting, again, from examiner.com, there are many links to learn more about the Hoboken mayor and the Secaucus mayor, links to their Facebook pages, and more on NJ.com out of New Jersey. The Jerusalem Post, of course, they're concerned about the rabbis from New York and New Jersey being arrested. But there are links to the New York Times, to Bloomberg, and on and on. But let's grab what's one of the most recent postings that I just grabbed off of Google News right now, Friday morning, July 24th, 2009. New Jersey scandal highlights cycle of ongoing corruption. The hapless state of New Jersey was absorbing yet another blow to its reputation following the eruption of its latest political corruption scandal that saw 44 people, including many prominent local politicians and officials, arrested for bribery. News of the sweeping arrests brought a wave of browbeating and cries of "here we go again" from commentators and political scientists in Jersey and beyond. Several expressed frustration at the inability to root out pervasive corruption at a local level that has infected many of the larger U.S. states. It's interesting to note that New Jersey is one of the smallest states in the country. Thurman Hart, an opinion writer with the New Jersey Star-Ledger, said the scandal pointed to a vicious cycle in the state's electoral system whereby any individual intent on cleaning up the mess finds it hard to get elected, and even if they negotiate that hurdle, they then find it impossible to effect change on their own. In other words, it isn't quite impossible to clean up Jersey City's government, but it's probably going to be easier to climb Mount Everest in a wheelchair. Among those arrested were 18 people connected with Jersey City, three mayors from cities across the state, two members of the New Jersey state government, and numerous senior officials. At the center of a case was a failed property developer who had been nailed by the FBI on fraud charges amounting to $25 million. Detectives managed to turn the man, named in U.S. papers as Solomon Dweck, D-W-E-K, into an informant who was then effectively acted as an undercover agent, exposing a much wider spider's web of corruption. Dweck posed as a developer wanting to build high-rise blocks in several of New Jersey's major cities, notable Jersey City and Hoboken. What he uncovered partially explains how such a fierce rate of building has occurred relatively unchecked by planning regulations. A central case in the scandal concerns Peter Camerano, a council member in Hoboken who successfully ran for mayor of the city this summer. He was introduced to Dweck through an unnamed political lobbyist who called Dweck "my guy." In a series of meetings in the New Jersey diners, decried by local observers as a cliché, The Sopranos was set there, Camerano and Dweck discussed the developer's desire to build high-rise offices. "To the extent that there's a pro-development person in this race, that's me," Camerano said. In the course of several rendezvous, Dweck offered the politician $5,000 for his election campaign and $5,000 delivered green, i.e. in cash, from the trunk of his car. In return, Dweck demanded of Camerano that he kept the money secret and helped expedite his planning approval. "You can put your faith in me," Camerano said. Though the billowing scandal has dismayed local observers, precisely this kind of political bribery in which electoral candidates have their campaign funds filled in return for property or other forms of favors is rife in many, though not all, parts of America. Richard Winters, a professor at Dartmouth College, has compiled a league table of states based on the number of corruption convictions that have occurred since 1977 per elected official. New Jersey is number 12 on the list. Well, surprise, surprise, guess which tops the list? America's Wang, Florida. Showing 100 times the rate of corruption in the cleanest state in the study, Vermont. Winter's research has led him to conclude that corruption is prevalent in large states where the sense of commonwealth or community has been severely diminished. He dismissed the idea that the corruption was used to fund political campaigns. "These are corrupt people who lack any sense of responsibility to their community. They're not out to finance a campaign. They're simply out to enrich themselves." And that's a good breakdown, and it basically puts it quite simply, that once your community breaks down, no one feels held back anymore. Nobody gives a shit about their neighbors. Yeah, what the fuck? I'm out for me. And I'll be the first to admit that I'm perhaps not the greatest neighbor in the world, the greatest friend in the world. But if you want to take a lot of the rhetoric and talking points of things we need to do and what we should work on and ban and all of that kind of garbage. You know that change starts within. And you can't legislate it. You can't sign a petition and fix everything. You have to start the change from within. You think plastic is a big, disgusting waste? You want to ban it? What if you just stop using it yourself? If you think man-made global warming is the cause of the imminent destruction of the planet, maybe you shouldn't drive so much. Maybe you should watch where your money goes. But don't legislate to me and to others about what they should do, what they can do, what they can't do, how many kids they can have, how much they want to run their air conditioner. Because again, when we see the coming carbon indulgences and the carbon tax paid to international banksters and elites with cap and trade companies pretty much being run at the behest of Al Gore, much to his wallet's benefit, they can afford to pay the carbon indulgences because they've already got the money. And they make their money by devaluing our dollars, which we, of course, get on loan from the fraudulent Federal Reserve and pay back with interest, even though Congress could stop it tomorrow. They blow out economies and they sweep in and scoop up all those real assets for dirt cheap. And you can't afford to do that. You know, I've looked at maybe trying to put money in like a CD and try and turn around and make a little money on it over a year or two or three or five even. But when you look at the breakdown, it's not worth it. God, if I threw, you know, even a couple $1,000 into a CD, it's going to give me a couple $100 maybe. It's not worth it. But if I were a gangster, bankster, Goldman Sachs bastard, if I could throw, you know, a couple mil into a CD, that's going to see some returns. What am I rambling about? You making the changes you want to see in the world. And it's all, I mean, Jesus, it's all kind of simple. No, there's no exact quick fix to the problems in the world. But we've said, of course, legalizing hemp for industrial uses would be a great thing and a huge, huge step. And even if you don't believe in Jesus, you don't believe in any God, you don't believe in Beatles, you just believe in me. The golden rule. What's the golden rule? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Which I believe does come from the Bible and it gets paraphrased. Treat others like you want to be treated. And that's it. I mean, that's really ultimately what it breaks down to. My friends, I hope you really enjoyed this 133rd episode of MediaMonarchy.com. It's July 24th, 2009. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm the host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com. Of course, again, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority. Now, what I want to tell you. PRARadio.org is involved this weekend in the 2009 PDX Pop Now Festival. PDXPopNow.com. It's a festival all this weekend here in Portland of Oregon-based musicians. And the Portland Radio Authority is going to be broadcasting a lot of those live shows and interviews. So there's even a compilation disc promoting PDX Pop Now. And even that disc has musicians that you may know, like M. Ward and Mira and Tara Jane O'Neill and others. And there's tons of other fantastic bands that are bubbling up. It's awesome to live in a city where you see bands that were just a little, maybe small flyer on telephone pole turn into, whoa, Bob Boylan on NPR is talking about him. Oh, there's a review in Spin. Bands like Blitzen Trapper, Starfucker, and others that aren't coming to me right now. What I'm basically saying is we're going to cease our regular broadcasting at 1 p.m. today. So Nathan Jimenez and Events of Our Times will not be heard today as we kind of shut down some of our gear and shift it over into the live PDXpopnow.com. PDX being the airport code for Portland, if you didn't know. So what's going to happen is I'm going to wrap up this episode 133 and keep it at the regular 2-hour broadcast time. And then we're going to shift in and immediately do a B-side. So if you're listening live, stay exactly where you are. If you're listening on the web at praradio.org or zeropointradio.com or revereradio.net, stay where you are. B-side 133 coming up. If you are listening to this or re-listening to this show later, make sure you get the B-side coming up imminently because it's all the stuff that we didn't go over. It's going to be rapid fire. It's going to be news purge style. All the 9/11 updates, bio wars, cyberspace war, drug wars, econo crash, enviro health, geopolitics, history mystery, media memes, murder and mayhem, Obamasiah and the apostles of war, police state international, and so much more coming up on the B-side. But let's blast out with a quick list of creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. The Navy Network Information Center out of Pensacola, Florida. We had Fort Lewis, lewis.army.mil. We had Fort Meade out of Maryland. They were reading way back on March 10th, 2007 on MediaMonarchy.com where I posted up about Emmanuel Goldstein's 50th birthday. Emmanuel Goldstein, of course, being our name for the mythological man known as Osama bin Laden. NorthropGrumman.com visited MediaMonarchy.com out of their servers in Redondo Beach, California. Foot, Cone, and Belding Communications out of New York City. They Googled Jonathan Bayless. He, of course, being the most recent mysterious death related to Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. Again, the headquarters of the USAISC out of Alexandria, Virginia. And I finally looked up what that stands for. That's the U.S. Army Information Systems Engineering Command. That's basically military people on the payroll out there engaging you on the internet. Remember, of course, the Information Operations Roadmap document said that they need to fight the net as an enemy weapons system. We had American Forces Information Service out of Alexandria, Google Vibrant Response, Seaburn. The State of Georgia Board of Regents out of Albany, Georgia, Googled Signs of Masonry in Media, Delta Airlines. The DOD Network Information Center out of Fayetteville, North Carolina, Googled Ardent Century 09. And finally, Merrill Lynch and Company out of Brooklyn, Googled Natural Health Solutions, Inc., Melvin K. So again, I implore you to sometimes check out some of those things that those people are checking out. It can definitely turn you on to maybe what the spooks and the insiders are looking at as important stories. But that's going to do it. This is episode 133, July 24th, 2009. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster, reminding you, as always, to get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Diary. or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.